The Pre-Paces podcast is brought to you by two brilliant sponsors. Paces Ahead is a fantastic four-day face-to-face Paces course run in Brentford, London. They bring you a whole host of patients with fascinating stories and reliable signs, and these patients are absolutely delighted to allow you to hone your exam skills prior to exam day. Some of the patients actually are used in the exams themselves, and the next courses are running from the 20th to the 23rd of May, and then I will be helping out on the course running on the 28th to the 31st of May. Please do come and say hello. I'd love to have a chat and hopefully help you on your way to passing your paces. But if you can't make the course for whatever reason, our other sponsor, Pass Test, has got you covered with their market-leading online revision resource. There are tons of videos which help you revise from the comfort of your own home, and most listeners that I've spoken to have said this is equally essential for your paces success. But that's enough for me for now. Let's get into this week's episode of the Pre-Paces podcast. Welcome, listeners. Dr. Sam Williams here, and this week we welcome along Dr. Stuart Brown, Cardiology Reg and Devices Fellow, to talk us through how to approach a patient presenting with a cardiac device on the medical take and how much information we can gather from a simple chest x-ray with a cardiac device on it. I really hope you enjoy this week's episode, and just the solo shout out on the Buy Me A Coffee page this week to the wonderful one letter name T, who sent some very kind words and a very generous donation to boot. I really appreciate any and all support you lovely listeners are able to give, and that's why the Buy Me A Coffee page is entirely voluntary and is a pay what you want format. I want this podcast to always be free at the point of use for all of you. I'm never going to put it behind a paywall or make you shell out 150 quid for the pleasure of listening. And you might hear the odd advert now and again, which helps keep the pod going, but rest assured, it will always remain free for all of you preparing for your exams at the point of use. But right now, let's get into my chat with Dr. Stuart Brown. Welcome to the Pre-Paces podcast. My name is Dr. Sam Williams, and we all know that sitting paces and being on the medical take in any capacity is partly being a detective, picking up clues that infer a particular condition and spotting hints by the bedside that gives a clue towards the background of any given patient. And this shouldn't stop at the door to your paces exam hall, but I firmly believe it is something you should use during your everyday clinical practice. So this episode, we're talking about something more related to your clinical practice, which you may use on the medical take and slightly less related to paces. We're going to be talking about how much information you can gather from three very simple elements. Number one is the patient demographics. Number two is their presenting symptom. And number three is a chest x-ray with a cardiac device on it. And to help guide us through this devices masterclass, we're delighted to welcome Cardiology Registrar in the Severn Deanery, Dr. Stuart Brown, who is currently taking some time out of training, completing a PhD related to pacemaker-related cardiomyopathy. So Stuart, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Excited to be here.
And so Stuart, this episode of the podcast, the crux of it is we want our listeners to not necessarily be experts, but we want them to be able to look at an x-ray with a cardiac device and have a decent stab about what they think might be going on. So what we're going to run through is the different types of cardiac devices that patients can have implanted. And then towards the end, we're going to be talking through some case studies and talking about the thought process that one of us as cardiology registrars might go through. You've been very kind and you've been able to help us prepare a number of cases, but also talk about the very basics of devices for a non-cardiologist. But first, Stuart, I want to ask you, how commonly do you come across patients with cardiac devices in your clinical practice, both in your capacity as a devices fellow or research fellow at the moment, and also in your day-to-day life as a cardiology registrar before you came out of training?
Yeah, so this is our bread and butter, really, as devices registrars. But I must say, even when you're on the medical take, you see a lot of cardiology, but a lot of patients with devices, particularly now that we use them for heart failure, the indications are expanding. So they seem to be creeping in everywhere.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely true to say that a non-cardiologist looking at either an ECG or an X-ray with a cardiac device in may not always know the indication for the device and may not always know what type of device it is and the indication for it. But hopefully by the end, the listeners will be able to hold their own and become their own experts in the interpretation of these X-rays and knowing the right course of action to take should a patient present with either a device-related problem or other symptoms where you think checking the device might be appropriate.
I hope so. That's why we're here.
Brilliant. So let's get started on our chat on pacemakers and X-rays. So Stuart, we're just going to start off by talking about the very basics of cardiac implantable devices. And as we've already alluded to, there are a number of devices which might be implanted in a patient for any number of reasons. So should we just go through those one by one? And we were going to start off, first of all, with a dual chamber pacemaker. So I wonder if you can explain for the audience, what exactly does a dual chamber pacemaker mean? And why might we put one into one of our patients?
So I think this is a good place to start because it's the device that we implant the most of. And so a dual chamber pacemaker consists of an atrial lead and a ventricular lead connected to a generator. The atrial lead is there to pace the atria, and that's in patients with sinus node disease. And the ventricular lead is there to pace the ventricles, patients with AV block. It's important to know when the pacemaker is going to deliver that ventricular contraction. And in an ideal world, what you want is the patient's sinus node to fire. You want the atria to contract and the blood to rush into the ventricles, and they have this brief pause. And in AV block, your own heart doesn't then stimulate the ventricles to contract, so the pacemaker has to do it for you. And so the atrial lead is there to encourage that communication between the heart and the pacemaker. There's some important distinctions to be made between atrial and ventricular pacing. Atrial pacing is very well tolerated by the heart, doesn't seem to cause any problems, whereas ventricular pacing isn't. And somewhere between a tenth and a quarter of patients develop problems with ventricular pacing in the form of either atrial fibrillation or left ventricular failure. And this is more common in older patients, patients with diabetes, ischemic heart disease, chronic kidney disease. And so in an ideal world, you avoid ventricular pacing as much as possible. And there's some clever algorithms built into these devices to minimize this. But some people are in complete heart block all the time and they need to be paced all the time. So whereas others don't.
Fantastic. I guess for our audience, it's important as well to know the anatomy around where the leads actually are. So when we talk about a dual chamber, you've talked about one lead in the atrial, one in the ventricle, but they're both on the right side of the heart, aren't we? They're in the venous system of the heart.
Yeah, so when we do the implant, we make a small incision under the clavicle, about a couple of inches long. We use a Seldinger technique, much like you would use with a chest drain, to insert some sheaths, which are little hollow tubes, into the venous system. So you're going ultimately into the subclavian vein. And what you do then is you pass an atrial lead into the roof or the top of the right atrium, right into the appendage, where it tends to be relatively secure. And you can screw these in with like a little corkscrew. Or sometimes we have anchors, which get stuck on the endocardial wall to secure them in place. In contrast, the ventricular lead goes through the atrium. You pass it through the tricuspid valve, which tends to irritate the heart a little bit for a couple of seconds. And then you either prolapse it or poke it into the right ventricle. And then you secure it. I think we're moving more towards putting it into the septum, but some people put it down in the apex.
Yeah, excellent. And I guess it's important just to describe how that would look for our audience in terms of if they were to see an X-ray of a patient with a dual chamber pacemaker. I think it's important to emphasize that the right side of the heart is actually more anterior. And so you're almost looking at the heart sort of side on. But what does the lead position actually look like if our listeners are looking at a chest X-ray? What do the leads actually look like on the X-ray?
Yeah, so the leads pass from underneath the clavicle down the midline. And then when you get to the level of the heart, or level of the sternum on the X-ray roughly, the atrial lead will do a 180 and loop back up on itself, almost forms like a U-shape. And the ventricular lead is pointing down towards the right hip normally if it's in the apex, or sometimes it will come down the midline and then point back up towards the left shoulder. Sorry, I said the right hip, the left hip and the left shoulder.
Yeah, fantastic. So that's our bog standard dual chamber pacemaker. As Stuart said, the commonest cardiac implanted device that we tend to put in. Moving on to the next device is a single chamber pacemaker, Stuart. So we talked about a dual chamber. What's the difference with a single chamber pacemaker?
So this refers to a single lead in the ventricle. So there's no atrial lead. We put these devices in people who have permanent atrial fibrillation. When you have permanent AF, your atria are constantly being, they're constantly contracting because of these tiny little chaotic wavelets that exist in the atria. And so if you try and stimulate the atria with your atrial lead, your action potential will immediately come up against this chaotic electrical activity, and you'll get no propagation of that impulse through the atria. So essentially atrial pacing doesn't work in atrial fibrillation. So we leave the AF alone and we just put a lead in the bottom of the heart and pace the ventricle as you need to.
Yeah. And you talked about the indications for a dual chamber pacemaker being particularly sinus node disease and atrioventricular block or nodal block, AV nodal block. So we know that our patient is probably in permanent atrial fibrillation if they have a single chamber pacemaker. So what would the different indications be for a patient who's in permanent AF who then requires pacing? What's the difference in the indication there?
I guess the question is, who in atrial fibrillation gets a pacemaker? Really, we're thinking about long symptomatic pauses in AF or complete heart block. Now, sometimes when the rate is quite slow in atrial fibrillation, it's difficult to work out whether this is just atrial fibrillation going slowly or whether it's complete heart block. And the distinction you have to make is by looking at the ECG. So AF going slowly should be irregular on the ECG, whereas complete AV block, the escape rhythm will be regular. So you'll have atrial fibrillation with a regular escape. So that's the important distinction to make.
And the other thing which can occasionally happen, Stuart, in these patients with atrial fibrillation is Tachy-Brady syndrome, which I guess is something which our listeners may well have heard of in the past. So I wonder if you can give us an idea of why we would implant a pacemaker in a patient who has a tachycardia or a Tachy-Brady syndrome, because on the face of it, it might seem a bit counterintuitive for a patient who has Tachy-Brady syndrome. So if a patient's got intermittent, fast and slow heart rates, why do we end up putting in pacemakers in Tachy-Brady, which is something which is strongly associated with AF?
Normally, when you've got someone with atrial fibrillation, they have rapid ventricular rates, you want to slow them down with beta blockers, calcium channel blockers. But sometimes when these patients go slowly, and they may be going slow with a sinus bradycardia, or they may be going slow in atrial fibrillation, your beta blockers will slow that down even further. And so patients may become symptomatic with sort of malaise, breathlessness, or even syncopal episodes. And in these patients where you've got evidence of fast and slow arrhythmias, you give them tablets to slow the tachyarrhythmias, and then you put a pacemaker in to treat the bradyarrhythmia aspect of it. And so just to come back to the choices of pacemaker, if you've got a patient who's going slow in AF, you'll just give them a single chamber pacemaker. But if you've got a patient who's going slow with sinus rhythm, they'll get a dual chamber pacemaker because you want to pace their atria.
So then moving on to our next implantable cardiac device. This one's slightly different because we're talking about an implantable cardioverter defibrillator. So Stuart, I wonder if you can explain to us, so what's the difference between a pacemaker and an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, which is a bit of a mouthful, so we'll call it an ICD. So I wonder if you can tell us how we can tell the difference between a pacemaker and an ICD on an X-ray, and then what's the functional difference between these two devices?
So if we'll start on the X-ray then, the most notable thing that you see on the X-ray is that the defibrillator is massive, and that's because it has a big battery in it. The second thing that you see is the leads look quite different. So the atrial lead will look very similar, but the ventricular lead has got something called a shock coil on it. So when you get down to the tip of the right ventricular lead, there's a very radio-opaque, so a lot white on the X-ray, thick tip, which is a couple of inches long, which is very different from a standard pacing lead, which is thin. When we're thinking about sizes, sort of the difference between the lead of a pencil is sort of what your ventricular lead is, Beagle Shock Lead is more like the width of a, not quite, but almost the width of the pencil. So it's much thicker.
Yeah, absolutely. You talked about the shock coil, and I guess that's the most important functional difference between the ICD and the pacemaker, is that a pacemaker is simply there to pick up slow heart rates, but it won't treat fast heart rates, whereas an ICD will do that.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, a pacemaker is there to treat bradyarrhythmias. A ICD is there to treat tachyarrhythmias. So at the ICD, we put it in for two reasons. One is you're preventing tachyarrhythmias in people who are at risk of them. Or the second is if someone's already had tachyarrhythmias, then you put it in to prevent them to harm from any further. And what the ICD does is there's two things that it can do. One is something called anti-tachycardia pacing. If we remember that ventricular arrhythmias are usually due to re-entry circuits in the heart, I think about this in my head as sort of a car getting stuck on a roundabout. What anti-tachy pacing does is it introduces a roadblock in front of that car that's stuck on a roundabout. So you rapidly pace the heart and you try and make the leading edge of that re-entry circuit refractory. And so it can terminate that ventricular arrhythmia. And that can work in as many as 80% of times. And the big advantage to that is that you avoid a shock. And that's the second thing that a defibrillator does, is in the name, it does defibrillation. So when the device detects a ventricular arrhythmia, it will deliver anti-tachycardia pacing whilst it charges. And if it's successful, it will dump the charge. But if it's unsuccessful or it hits certain criteria, you'll get a high voltage shock from the generator just underneath the clavicle down to the shock lead on the right ventricular lead. And what that does is it depolarizes all your myocardial cells and then they all become refractory. And then your sinus node can hopefully take over in a nice normal rhythm and you terminate the ventricular rhythm.
And the patient will know about that.
The patient may know about that. You hope that they don't. So these ventricular arrhythmias, the reason you put in ICDs is they're associated, these ventricular arrhythmias cause blackouts and they also cause sudden death. So you hope the patient's blacked out because then they don't remember it, but they don't always black out. So sometimes they say, you know, it felt like someone had kicked me in the chest, but sometimes patients say, I didn't know my defibrillator had gone off. I just woke up on the floor or, you know, I woke up from sleep.
Yeah, excellent. And as you say, you hope the patient doesn't remember it, because often, or at least in my experience, the patients who do remember it, I think there's a fair amount or fair prevalence of PTSD in patients after having shocks from their devices. But anyway, we're moving on to the next device. So we're moving on from ICDs. And now we're talking about something called cardiac resynchronization therapy, which you may see abbreviated in the medical notes as CRT. And these can be suffixed with either a P or a D. So Stuart, I wonder if you can explain to us, what's the difference between the CRT devices and then the bradycardia pacemaker devices we've discussed and an ICD, which we've just gone through?
Yeah, so a CRT device is a normal bradycardia pacemaker, but it has the addition of a left ventricular lead. So you might ask, how do you get a lead into the left ventricle? Well, you don't go in through the same method as you might with a right ventricular lead. You can't just go in through a subclavian artery and then go around. As soon as you put things like leads into the left ventricle, they clot. And so what we have to do is we have to go outside the left ventricle. And conveniently, there is a little hole in the right atrium called the coronary sinus, where the coronary sinus ostium, which drains the coronary sinus. And if you place a very small windy lead into the coronary sinus and push it down the vein, it will track around the back of the left ventricle. So what happens is you have a lead inside the right ventricle, and then you have a lead outside the left ventricle. So that's why it's often referred to as a biventricular pacemaker. So you've got an RV lead, an LV lead, and depending on whether you're in atrial fibrillation or not, you may have an atrial lead. On top of that, you may or may not have a defibrillator function. So that right ventricular lead, if it's got a shock coil on it and you attach it to an ICD generator, that would be a CRTD. Or if you just have a standard pacemaker lead, then that would be a CRTP. So they're two distinct technologies that do different things. And I suppose that one of the next questions is, why do we have CRTs? What do we implant CRTs for? There's two main indications for that. One is you're treating heart failure. So the big advantage to cardiac resynchronization therapy is sort of in the name, and it resynchronizes the ventricle. So in certain patients with heart failure, they develop left bundle branch block, which leads to dyssynchrony within the left ventricle and also between the ventricles. So what we do is we place the lead in the right ventricle, outside the left ventricle, and then pace them together, and you improve the synchronicity of that heartbeat. So you'll take a QRS duration on the ECG of 170, 180 milliseconds, which is quite a broad left bundle branch block, and you can reduce that to somewhere between 120 and 130 milliseconds. And people feel much better, their heart function picks up, their left ventricular function picks up, and they live longer.
Yeah, fantastic. And we see the benefits from these devices being implanted often in clinic after they've had them put in, and we see the benefits on the echocardiograms after they're followed up as well. And patients often do feel a lot better afterwards. So that's the value of putting in these CRT devices. And so you've already described, Stuart, how this would look on a chest x-ray. Unless the patient's in permanent AF, they would still have the right atrial lead as described, making that small U-shape on sort of the patient's just on the right side of the sternum, just to the right of the sternum. You would still have a lead in the right ventricle, pointing down either down towards the apex or up towards the patient's left shoulder. But then you would also have a smaller, as you described, a small caliber, windy, long lead, which is often seen above the right ventricle lead on a chest x-ray. And you may see sort of bright white dots on the left ventricular lead, which are the various poles which the device can pace from. So that's another giveaway that this is a left ventricular lead. And similarly to the ICD, the CRTs are also of a larger size as well. And I guess one other thing which we wanted just to touch on is that the majority of patients have their devices placed on the under the left clavicle, but there are a subset of patients who end up having right-sided devices. And that's something which is obvious on an x-ray, because you would see a device on underneath the right clavicle rather than the left. So, Stuart, what are the reasons that a patient might end up having a right-sided device rather than on the left side?
Essentially, if something has gone wrong on the left, all our standard implants go on the left-hand side. But if one of these gets infected and it has to come out, and any prosthetic material in the body that gets infected usually has to come out, and pacemakers are no exception. You then may need to put a pacemaker back in at some stage, but you don't put it in an infected pocket or previously infected pocket. You put it on the contralateral side, you put it on the right-hand side. In the last couple of years, we've started doing, or the last 10, 20 years, doing a lot more radiotherapy. So if you've got breast, esophageal, or lung cancer, and your pacemaker is in the way of your radiation field, we may move or implant the pacemaker on the opposite side. Historically, we used to ask patients if they're left or right-handed, and if you were left-handed, we might put it on the right-hand side. Anecdotally, we don't seem to do that anymore. The exception in Somerset is if you shoot clay pigeons and you don't want your shotgun butt coming into your pacemaker on your left, underneath your left clavicle, if you're left-handed. But again, we don't generally take left-handedness or right-handedness into account unless it's certain situations.
Yeah, one of the hazards of working in the deepest, darkest West Country is deciding whether or not to take into account someone's shooting preferences. Goes hand in hand with seeing multiple farmers on the medical take on any given day.
So maybe just before we move on, I did forget to mention that I said there were two indications for CRT. One we've talked about is left bundle branch block and severely impaired LV function, heart failure. The other is people whose heart function is poor and they need a bradycardia pacemaker. So we know that if you put a normal pacemaker in someone who, let's say, has an ejection fraction about 40%, they have moderate LV impairment, and then you pace them all the time, those are the patients who develop heart failure and they come into hospital with heart failure admissions. So although that patient doesn't strictly fulfill the criteria for, you know, broad left bundle branch block and severely impaired LV function, if they're going to pace all the time, we'll put an SCRT to prevent problems in the future.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, listeners, well, now we're going to move on to some clinical cases. And hopefully this is going to be really applicable for your day-to-day practice, because on any given day in the medical tape, multiple patients come in with either incidentally, they may have a cardiac device, or they may have symptoms related to a device. But either way, we're going to talk through some of these cases which we've written up, and having this sort of knowledge at your fingertips can be really helpful in managing these patients at the front door. So for each case, we are going to give you the patient demographics, we're going to give you some presenting symptoms, and we will do our best to describe their chest x-ray for you. And while we're talking through that, we want you to have a think about what we describe, what your plan would be, think about what type of pacemaker they have, and what would be your management and assessment of this patient at the front door? What would you be concerned about? Listeners, I'm delighted to welcome a brand new podcast partner, Scrubs, in all caps, S-C-R-B-S. This company is run by two GPs and they make awesome scrubs. I've been wearing mine for a couple of weeks now and they absolutely strike the balance between being comfortable, functional, and appearing professional at work at a decent price. And they're even more affordable when you use the discount code PACES10 to get 10% off any order. Just head to scrubs.co.uk, S-C-R-B-S.co.uk, and use the code PACES10 for 10% off your order at the checkout. So listeners, the way this is going to work is I'm going to give Stuart the patient demographics and the presenting symptoms, and then he's going to ask me some questions, which you can, if you wish, incorporate into your own assessment of the patient's x-ray to give you some answers. So Stuart, case number one, there is a 75-year-old lady who has presented with dizzy spells and presyncope, and you have a chest x-ray which shows a left-sided implanted cardiac device.
Okay, so maybe I can ask you a couple of questions about this chest x-ray. How many leads are there coming out of this pacemaker?
So there are two leads coming out of this pacemaker.
Okay, so this sounds a lot like a dual chamber pacemaker so far. Tell me, is it the generator, is it relatively small, about a 50 pence piece size, or is it a big chunky thing about the size of a palm of someone's hand?
So it's a relatively small generator.
Okay, so that moves me towards thinking that this is a pacemaker rather than a defibrillator. And just to confirm that, we'll make sure that when we're looking at the tip of that right ventricular lead, is it sort of thin and wiry, or has it got this big white chunky thing on the end of it?
Yeah, so it's a thin and wiry RV lead, which is pointed right down to the patient's far left, and it's sitting somewhere in the RV apex on the patient's far left-hand side.
So I'm pretty confident that this sounds like a dual chamber pacemaker. So I think what we have to work on here is why is someone who's got a pacemaker in has had dizzy spells and almost collapsed? And one of the things that you're thinking about in your head is, has this got anything to do with A, her underlying heart problems, or B, the pacemaker? And I think where we start, as with everything in medicine, particularly in PACES, is the history. And I want to differentiate whether this is a true arrhythmic sort of syncope or presyncope, or is it something else? So the thing that I get really worried about when I'm listening to a story is syncope as opposed to presyncope. And the questions that I normally ask people are, did you get any warning? Do you remember falling? Do you remember hitting the floor? And were you able to protect yourself from the fall? And if they answer no to all of those, that tells me that this sounds a lot like cardiac syncope. It sounds like, Sam, this wasn't the case with this lady. She was sort of dizzy spells and presyncope.
Yeah, that's it. So it's dizzy spells and presyncope, but she didn't lose consciousness. She didn't pass out.
So I'd go dive into the history a little bit more and try to understand whether this is vagal. So we think about the three Ps for vagal. So whether there's a prodrome, is that, if you ever fainted, you'll be familiar with that feeling of the world closing in, going hot and clammy and sweaty, your vision goes. That's a typical prodrome. It's often provoked. So whether it's pain or blood or heat or food or standing up, Well, and that's the other thing is postural. It's often, you know, old people get out of bed in the morning, people get off the toilet, people are gardening and are kneeling down and then stand up. That's the classic vagal story. I think if this was someone who's got a pacemaker in, who's got a typical story of syncope as opposed to presyncope, I'm a bit more worried. And in that situation, there's the two differentials that I'm worried about. One is that there's a problem with the pacemaker, and two is that there's potentially a ventricular arrhythmia here. So in order to look into this a bit further, I would look at the x-ray and I'd look at the ECG. And when you go back to look at that x-ray that you nicely described earlier, I'd have a good look at the leads and I'd make sure to see if any of the leads are fractured. What you see is that the silicon around the edge wears a little bit like your headphones do, or in the days of wireless phones, we don't do that anymore, more like your iPhone charger. If the patient's had a pacemaker in recently, it may be that the lead has moved. And that's normally pretty obvious to see on the x-ray. So most places will do an x-ray after the pacemaker is implanted on the same day. So that's your baseline. That's where the operator left that pacemaker lead. If it's in somewhere wildly different, then the lead is displaced, and that's why your pacemaker is not working. So they have an untreated or unprotected bradyarrhythmia. Very occasionally, the lead will perforate and it will move through particularly the right ventricular apex, which is very thin, sometimes out into the pericardial space and sometimes the lung. That is very easy to spot on an x-ray because it's gone out the other side of the heart. And occasionally, you do see that. So that's what you look for on the x-ray. If you turn your attention then to the ECG, you may find evidence that the pacemaker is not working properly. So what you should see on an ECG when the pacemaker is working is you often see a tiny vertical line. You don't see it so much in bipolar pacing. You see it, the big chunky line in unipolar pacing, but in bipolar it can be quite subtle. But you see a pacing spike, and then you should see either a P wave for atrial pacing or a QRS complex for ventricular pacing. Now, if you're seeing pacing spikes and then you're not seeing electrical activity after that, either P waves or QRS complexes, we call that loss of capture. And that is a worrying sign that this pacemaker is not working. This can happen because over time the patient develops another cardiomyopathic process. So anything that scars the heart, sometimes they've been through an MRI scanner, but sometimes the leads either fail or the leads move very slightly. So when you're putting all that together, when you look at the combination of the chest x-ray and the ECG, you can see evidence of either loss of capture or the pacemaker leads have moved. And then if it's not the pacemaker not working, then you have to think about whether it's something else like an arrhythmia. Now, atrial arrhythmias don't tend to cause syncope. They might cause pre-syncope, but in the context of a structurally normal heart, and most pacemaker patients should have a normal heart, AF or flutter or an SVT, going very fast will not cause syncope. It may cause pre-syncope and palpitations. So if the patient is syncopal, one of the questions is this ventricular tachycardia? We mentioned earlier that a proportion of patients develop heart failure in response to long-term RV pacing, but only a very small proportion of these develop ventricular arrhythmias. So it's somewhere in the region of, you know, 1 in 20, 1 in 50 patients with heart failure in response to pacing that develop a ventricular tachycardia.
Fantastic. And I guess the other important thing to think about is that pacemakers can almost act as a Holter monitor. They are able to store these arrhythmic events, which I guess is important because one thing we look for in cardiology all the time is rhythm-symptom correlation, and pacemakers are able to give us that. And so the easiest way of trying to figure out if there is a concerning arrhythmia would simply be just to get the device checked, right?
Absolutely. And if you're fortunate enough to be in a tertiary center where you've got a physiologist on call or a cardiology reg on call that will come and interrogate the pacemaker, then that sort of mitigates most of this. But if you're in a DGH like we are, and you have to wait till the next day to get this device interrogated, then you've got to start using your clinical acumen to work out what's going on with this patient. But absolutely, if you've got a physiologist or a cardiologist who can come and look at the device, that makes life much easier.
Yeah. And that's something which, as you say, will depend on local geography and depending on your trusts. And that is something which is really valuable. If you're not a cardiologist, you're not regularly in touch with the device's physiologists, it can be really helpful just to pop your head into the office and say, you know, do you guys work at weekends or do you have someone who's on call out of hours? Because that sort of thing might get you out of trouble in a sticky spot.
Yeah. If you're seeing someone who you're worried about, who's had a syncopal episode with a cardiac device in, they should be seen by a physiologist to have a look at the device and ideally a cardiologist. And I'd put them on telemetry. It's a very different story for someone who's had a bit of a dizzy do. Maybe there's some postural element to their story and they also have a pacemaker in. So I think when you combine taking a good history and working out what the device they've got in, it can help you work out what's best to do for that patient.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess one of the things which may be something which is commonly seen is that you have a patient with a history that we've given, which is maybe one of more dizzy spells or presyncope. As a precaution, which is completely reasonable, you choose to get the device checked. And if there's no movement of the leads, there's no lead malfunction, and the pacemaker is functioning normally, and there's no tachyarrhythmias detected to explain the symptoms, is it fair to say that you should be looking for alternative causes of dizzy spells or presyncope, which are non-cardiac in nature and may be related to postural hypotension, for example, or polypharmacy or vasovagal syncope?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it becomes difficult when you see these patients on the take on a Friday evening. And the question is, does this patient need to stay all weekend to, you know, wait till Monday for a device check? I think the ones who've been syncopal really need that. The ones who've not got such a strong story, that's less certain. But if you've had the device checked and there's no arrhythmia there, then we need to start going looking for other causes for their symptoms.
Fantastic. So we're going to move on to case number two now. And I'm going to give you a different patient demographic and I'm going to give you a different presenting symptom. And I'm also going to give you, the info that you asked about before, Stuart. I'm going to give you the position of the leads and the number of leads.
Perfect.
So case number two, you're just about to clerk a 65-year-old man who's presented with palpitations and presyncope. You have a chest x-ray which shows a left-sided implanted cardiac device. You can see that it has a right atrial lead forming the characteristic U shape. You can see it has a right ventricular lead directed towards the cardiac apex. That lead appears to have a thicker segment towards the distal portion of the lead, and you think you see an LV lead positioned just above, following a winding course above the right ventricular lead, and you can see the four bright white dots denoting the four different poles. You can also see on the chest x-ray that he has some sternotomy wires present, and you can't see any valve replacement ring evident on the chest x-ray. So Stuart, this is a slightly more complicated x-ray than case number one. So I wonder, can you just talk us through what you can tell from this x-ray? How much information does it give us if one of our listeners sees this type of image on the medical take?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a bit of a gem of an x-ray. I think we're both learning how hard it is to describe x-rays. So this sounds a lot like a defibrillator. You've got a big chunky generator. You've got a thick tip sort of right ventricular lead. But you've also described that sort of windy left ventricular lead that goes behind the left ventricle. So putting all that together, that is a CRT defibrillator. So most likely this patient has got severe heart failure and they've either had or are at risk of ventricular arrhythmias. That leads you on to the next question is, why has this patient got heart failure? And if you've got sternotomy wires, that does suggest that this patient's had previous cardiac surgery. And then when you think about why people have that, it's either valve surgery or coronary artery bypass grafting. And in the absence of a valve, you have to conclude here that this is coronary artery bypass grafting. And you can sometimes see the clips that they use for the lemur artery. Or sometimes you can even see the sort of chicken wire appearance of stents that they've either had done before or after their bypass grafting. So I think putting all that together, you've described to me just from an x-ray this patient who's got an ischemic cardiomyopathy with a defibrillator in place. Now, when you add in a combination of palpitations and presyncope, the first thing that comes into my head and with someone with that story and ischemic cardiomyopathy is this a ventricular arrhythmia? And so the first thing I do is make sure that this patient is in a safe place. So if they're in a corridor in the emergency department, that's not the right place for them. They need to be on telemetry. So yes, they've got a device in, so they're protected, but we can't read this device. So it's really helpful for them, this patient, to be on telemetry. I then take a history and I'm thinking about why these patients have ventricular arrhythmias. So either it's an acute ischemic event, so they've had a heart attack. So I'd think about chest pain and the usual symptoms of a heart attack, or that this is a ventricular arrhythmia due to an old scar. And often there isn't really much that precedes that presentation. Sometimes they might have an infectious illness, maybe a diarrheal illness that will upset their electrolytes. You'll find the potassium is 2.6 when you do the gas. So they would be the main things that I'm looking for. And then once you've got this patient into a safe place, you might think about some of their medication. Do we need to optimize their heart failure therapy a bit further, make sure they're on all the pillars of heart failure therapy, make sure we've had a look at their ECG, obviously looking for acutely ischemic changes. You can learn a lot from the ECG. Make sure you may even be able to confirm that this is a CRT device by looking at relatively narrow QRS complex on the ECG. Overall, so far, my hunch is that this patient has an ischemic cardiomyopathy and he's had an episode of VT.
Yeah, absolutely. These cases are jazzed up for dramatic effect, but this is a perfectly realistic example of something which you could see on the medical tape. And what Stuart says is absolutely right. You're looking at heart failure medication, so the four pillars, and probably most pertinent as well, is to see if he's on a beta blocker, and if he is, what's the dose? Because this might be the medication which can suppress his heart rate if he has indeed had a ventricular arrhythmia. And so, at risk of repeating myself, Stuart, as well as popping this patient on some telemetry and making sure they're in a monitored bed where they're going to have ideally some eyes on them, or at least be readily seen if they were to deteriorate, interrogating the device should give you the answer as to why this patient has palpitations and why they might be presyncopal.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the key here. And as we've talked about, it is commonly a ventricular arrhythmia. But I think you said that this patient had an atrial lead in. So at least at the time of implant, this patient was in sinus rhythm. But the other thing that commonly causes palpitations and feeling unwell, presyncopal in this population, is rapidly conducted atrial fibrillation. So there are your two differentials here. And conveniently, you treat them in a very similar fashion with beta blockers. So I think with someone who's got this history and presentation, increasing the bisoprolol, giving a stat dose of bisoprolol on a medical take would be very, very reasonable.
Absolutely. And so there's a whole lot you can tell from an x-ray like that. And as Stuart says, thinking about things like acute coronary syndrome, but the ECG will tell you a lot as well. So it'll have to be taken into context, as well as your history with the x-ray and the ECG, and putting it all together to hopefully figure out why this patient was presyncopal and why they had palpitations. But interrogating the device as well is going to be really, really important. I think the other thing just to say is I think this is a patient which the cardiologist would want to know about. We want to know about these patients because these are the types of patients that need our help, or the help of the physiology team to help try and suppress these ventricular arrhythmias, which can cause patients to collapse suddenly.
Yeah, I think anyone with a device who's got symptoms, ultimately, it's very helpful for us to have a physiologist to come and have a look at the device and let us know what's going on. But in that gap between when that's available and when you see them, there's a lot that we can do based on basic good clinical medicine, taking a history, examining the patient, ECG and chest x-ray, so you can have a good idea of what's going on, and then also prioritise whether this is someone to worry about or this is someone that you can you won't be losing sleep over.
Brilliant. So moving on to case number 3. Now, this one is slightly different to the previous two, But I'm going to describe another patient for you, Stuart. This time we've got a 45-year-old man who has presented with presyncope followed by a shock from his device. His chest x-ray shows an implanted cardiac device on the left side with a single lead, which appears to be in the right ventricle facing down towards the patient's left hip. And the lead appears to be a defibrillator lead with the thicker caliber terminal portion of the lead. So what are your thoughts about this case initially?
I guess as a non-cardiologist, you might be thinking, why has a 45-year-old person got a defibrillator? You and I, Sam, see this a bit more often, and so it's not an immediate surprise, but I would ask the same question. Why has this patient got a defibrillator? One of the first questions when you're thinking about the x-ray that might lead you towards the diagnosis is just looking at the size of the heart. If you've got someone who has cardiomegaly, relatively young age, you're thinking more about a cardiomyopathy. Whereas if you've got someone who's got a very small heart, looks normal on x-ray, you might be thinking more about a channelopathy. And you could look into that a little bit further by looking at the ECG. Again, you could have some clues as to whether this is a channelopathy or a cardiomyopathy on the ECG. When we're thinking about differential diagnoses, So one of the differentials for these patients who are young, who've got defibrillators, who've got a cardiomyopathy, would be a dilated cardiomyopathy, so a severe dilated cardiomyopathy. And again, much like the patients that we discussed earlier, they can either be primary or secondary prevention, so either to prevent ventricular arrhythmias or to treat ventricular arrhythmias. And that's really the pattern that we have with ICDs in general in cardiology. So dilated cardiomyopathy, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The big one really is arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy or arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. That's a particularly malignant cardiomyopathy that you get sort of fibrofatty infiltration of the right heart, and that's your substrate for ventricular arrhythmias. So they're the main cardiomyopathies that affect young people that would mean you have a defibrillator in. You can often then look at the ECG. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy has, you get this left ventricular strain pattern. So you have very large QRS complex voltages, and you have ST depression, which can be profound throughout all the leads, but mainly laterally or infralaterally. ARVC or arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, you typically get anterior T-wave inversion. You may get a little notch in the V1 to V3 QRS complex called an epsilon wave. Or you may see some right axis deviation or right bundle branch block as the right heart starts to dilate. And with a dilated cardiomyopathy, commonly you see a left bundle branch block pattern. So that's your cardiomyopathies that affect young patients. In contrast, you then have channelopathies. So this is a problem at a cellular level, in contrast to the cardiomyopathy where you see a very abnormal heart, a channelopathy. The heart looks structurally normal when you do a scan, when you do an echo or an MRI scan, but the way that the action potential conducts can be very abnormal and is prone to ventricular arrhythmias. So those two most common ones that you'll probably have heard of are Brugada syndrome and long QT syndrome. And so if your patient's got a small heart on the x-ray, that would make us think, well, it's more likely to be a channelopathy. And the important thing for both of those channelopathies is the ECG presentation can come and go, particularly with Brugada. You know, literally one minute it can be there, and then the next minute it can be gone. And it tends to come on with fever and certain drugs. And with long QT, often the QT isn't very long. You know, it's at the top end of the normal range at 460, 470 milliseconds. It's an easy diagnosis to make if it's at 500 and 550. But often it can be quite subtle. So you may see a small heart, a defibrillator, and a QT of 470 milliseconds, which is just at the top end of the normal range for a female.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the other thing just to say is that if the patient has an ICD in already, the expectation would be that they have an existing diagnosis. Now, the one tricky thing which might cause a stumbling block if you're seeing this patient on the medical take is if they're out of area, for example, and you don't have that information. But there is likely to be a whole host of information available either from their clinic letters, either before their decision to implant a device, or if they've already been followed up afterwards, there's going to be a reason, an existing diagnosis, and that's either going to be primary prevention or secondary prevention, regardless of the diagnosis. And then the other thing, which is going to be really important, which may well yield a diagnosis as well, or certainly would be, will have been done, is an echocardiogram, where the report may well be available on your local systems. So those are both really important things to look for, is whether or not they've got an existing diagnosis or an echocardiogram. And because these patients tend to be slightly younger in these inherited conditions, it may well be that they already know their diagnosis and are able to tell you rather than be completely clueless about the whole thing, Stuart.
Yeah, I mean, that would be very helpful if the patient would give us all the diagnosis and maybe some clinic letters and open their NHS app. That'd be fantastic. And often they do. I think when we think about these young people who've had a shock from their device, these are the patients that you phone up coronary care and you say, have you got a bed? I'm bringing a 45-year-old patient who's had a shock from their device, because they need to be in a place of safety, particularly because there's a small risk of them having further shocks, and they're quite unpleasant for the patient. The devices are programmed to deliver shocks under certain conditions, and sometimes patients, actually particularly young ones, may tolerate ventricular arrhythmias quite well. And so getting these patients to a place of safety where the device has potentially saved their life and got them into hospital, but often when they're in a specialist unit like a coronary care unit, we may even temporarily deactivate the defibrillator if it keeps going off, and then only manually defibrillate them if they lose output or have syncopal episodes. And so getting them somewhere safe that they can be well looked after is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just going to nip back to one thing you mentioned, Stuart, which is about talking about or thinking about factors which may affect their risk of ventricular arrhythmia. So you mentioned about having a fever, which is going to be particularly important as well, but also just think about the correctable things. So are they adequately hydrated? Have they taken any illicit drugs? Have they taken a lot of energy drinks or caffeine or alcohol? And are their electrolytes okay? And these are all simple correctable things which you might be able to assist with when you see them at the front door.
Yeah, there's a couple of that are specific to some of these conditions. So as you mentioned, fever is relatively unique to Brugada. Electrolytes are hypokalemia, more than hyperkalemia, a bit more proarrhythmic. So correcting both hypokalemia and hypomagnesemia. And if you've got someone with one of these young chalopathy patients with ventricular arrhythmias, often giving some magnesium is actually very helpful, and it can stabilize things quite nicely.
I guess the other thing is whether or not they've been able to take their medications. If they're taking an antiarrhythmic drug to prevent these arrhythmias, have they had something like a DNV bug? Have they been vomiting? Have they not been able to take or not been absorbing their medications? That's another reason why maybe they may well have developed that. And also vomiting may not also help their electrolytes from a potassium point of view. So that's something maybe just to watch out for. And I guess the other thing, Stuart, which is actually probably more related to PACES than most of the stuff we've talked about, is about driving after a device therapy, because especially in these young patients, we know that there is a driving restriction for these patients. So how does that or what is the usual driving restriction for these patients who have a shock therapy?
Yeah, so the first thing I'd say about the DVLA guidance is it changes more often than you think. And so if you've not looked it up recently, I'd recommend checking it. And that, I mean, maybe every 6 months, because it does change. So if you've had an appropriate shock from a device, and we can do something to mitigate that risk in the future, for example, increasing your medication. So a bit more bisoprolol, adding in amiodarone, having a VT ablation, all those things sort of mitigate that future risk. Then it's a 6-month driving ban. If we can't do anything to mitigate that risk, it's often longer and that can be a bit variable. Sometimes these devices go off by mistake. So if you have a very fast supraventricular tachycardia that is going at 200 beats a minute, and the device often will confuse that for VT and it goes off by mistake, that's a 1-month driving ban. The driving advice is really important. Where it comes into it for us is often there's a patient will have a shock in the community or blackout in the community, and they sometimes need to come into hospital. And if you're the medical reg on call and you're having to deal with this situation, it's important that you say to them, you need someone else to drive you into the hospital.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just important to say that this is correct at the time of recording, and we would always recommend that you do check before you give advice to your patients. And it's very easy to find, you know, it's simply Googling DVLA And I think it's under cardiovascular disorders, assessing fitness to drive. And there's a whole list of cardiovascular conditions where you can check. Just checking now, Stuart, actually the other important thing is for patients who have drive a group two vehicle, so a bus or a lorry. At the moment, as I say, correct to the time of recording, but as it says here, the license will be refused or revoked permanently. And that is the type of thing which you may find in your PACE's Breaking Bad News station, where you have to deliver that to a patient.
Yeah, absolutely. We often have HDV drivers that have come in after a heart attack and they've got severe LV dysfunction. We're having these difficult conversations about whether to offer them a defibrillator or not. One of the sort of catch-alls is really if their LV function is poor, often they can't drive anyway. And that's not just lorries, but also bus drivers or large vehicles that we need to be really careful about giving appropriate driving advice to.
Yeah, absolutely. So Stuart, I think we've pretty much covered everything we had planned to discuss with regard to cardiac implanted devices and chest x-rays. Do you have any final closing thoughts for any of our listeners if they come to assess any patients who have a cardiac device on the medical take and they're not sure what to do? What would be your final thoughts, your final bits of advice for the listeners?
I would say, as always, take a good history, examine the patient, look at the device on the x-ray, the ECG. You may get some information from the medical notes about diagnosis and what this device is in for. If the history sounds like proper cardiac syncope, they've got a device in, you want to be prioritizing getting that device checked and speaking with a cardiologist.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's about all we've got time for this week's show. So that only leaves us to say a huge thank you to Dr. Stuart Brown, Cardiology Devices Fellow. We're very grateful for you giving up part of your evening, Stuart, for giving us a bit of education on devices and chest x-ray interpretation. A huge thank you from all the listeners.
Great. Thank you, Sam.
And so listeners, as we say, that is just about all the time we've got for this week's show. Please don't forget, you can like, follow and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We always love to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can do that on the Twitter at PrePaces Podcast or via the website. And if you really want to go above and beyond, you can support the show directly at buymeacoffee.com/PrePacesPodcast. But for now, we're just about out of time. I've been Dr. Sam Williams. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on the PrePaces Podcast.